Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane hopes to be back on the air next week. They look like miniature horses with rolling eyes and monkey tails. They change colors if by magic, and the males appear to give birth to their young. The creature I'm describing is the seahorse. Marine biologist Helen Scales joins me in the studio to talk about this elusive sea creature that has captured the human imagination for centuries. She's written a new book titled Poseidon's Sea Steed, The Story of Seahorses from Myth to Reality. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks, Susan. It's great to be here.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850, or you can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org, or send us a tweet, or send us a question by Facebook. Now, you spent years looking for a seahorse in the wild before you finally saw one. When did you finally catch up with a wild seahorse?
Actually, you'll be amazed to hear it was while I was doing research for the book. I had spent over a decade scuba diving, researching around the world, having a wonderful time, seeing lots of extraordinary creatures. But the seahorses just weren't there. I just couldn't find one. I was never in quite the right place at the right time. But my research for the book took me to Vietnam, because I was looking into how seahorses are caught for the medicine trade. And after I'd finished spending a time on a trawl boat, seeing how these creatures are caught, I took a bit of time off and I went diving. And it was fantastic because I'd been told that there were some seahorses on a tiny island just off the coast of Nha Trang, which is on the southwest coast of southeast coast of Vietnam. And there it was. It really was a moment I had imagined for decades, but I had got it wrong, actually. I thought I'd see this amazing, beautiful, intricate seahorse, and I'd dance around and be excited and sort of ecstatic. But I was actually just gripped by this immense just sort of satisfaction that I'd finally found one. After all this time, they really do live in the sea. I had proof in front of me, and it was as beautiful as I had imagined. It was fantastic.
You know, I think some people might say you had been searching for a wild seahorse all this time, become so interested in them that you were working on a book, and yet you had never seen one. What do you think had captured you so much about the seahorse?
It's a really good question. Ever since I'd learned to dive, it really was. I don't remember a time when I didn't want to see one, I guess. It's always been up there. Something about the way they look, their magical, just otherworldly appearance. They do look like a fairy tale. They just as likely could be something like a unicorn or a mermaid. It just can't be real. And that, I guess, is almost what drove me to write the book, was trying to understand why they're so captivating, why they're so enchanting. What is it that's so intoxicating about these little fish? I mean, they're just little fish that live on the bottom of the sea. Why do I want to see those more than anything else? And why have they for thousands of years inspired people to make great artwork, mythology, legends, all those other things, magic potions, all sorts of things? I guess that was it. It was that question in my mind of, well, why are they so special?
They are so odd looking. They have a horse's head and a big curved neck and a tail. Now, is it true it's the only fish that has a neck?
Yeah, it has its head bent over. That makes it that it has a neck, and no other fish do that, which is bizarre. But it does make sense. If you look at the way seahorses live their lives, actually all those characters that seem to be a bit strange and a bit like they've borrowed them from another animal make them perfectly suited to their own particular way of life.
Why do they need a neck?
Well, that, if you can imagine, if they were still staring straight up into the sky, they might have a bit of trouble spying their food, because they eat tiny little zooplankton, little shrimp that swim around in the water column. And you can imagine having your head bent over at 90 degrees or thereabouts helps them to spy those food out. And their long, thin snouts, which make them look like a horse, are perfect for sucking up and, first of all, just zeroing in on a little shrimp and then sucking it up and eating it. So it's all part of how they feed, I think.
And how about the monkey tail?
Well, they gave up speed. That was one of the things that happened in the evolutionary pathway of seahorses from their ancestors. For some reason, they decided to stop swimming around with a big tail fin to push them through the water. And instead, they evolved this appendage, and if you see a seahorse alive, whether it's in an aquarium or in the wild, you'll see just how how dexterous and sensitive their tails are. They're like an elephant's trunk. It's extraordinary. They can turn any way they want. They can scratch their heads. They can wrap it around their necks. But basically, the reason they have it is so that they can hold on tight to wherever they're living, whether it's a seagrass bed or a coral reef. And they don't get blown away when the current starts to blow.
You know, it's one result of them having this very distinctive look was a long debate over whether they were a fish or an insect or an amphibian or what they were as recently as the 19th century. What was the debate about? What other kinds of creatures did they think the seahorse could be?
It was a big debate for just literally, well, ever since we saw them, people have been wondering what they are. Back in medieval times, traders thought they'd found baby dragons. And I like to think maybe there was something in that that was true. But no, Victorian scientists thought maybe it'd be insects, because one of the things that's different about seahorses compared to virtually every other fish is that they don't have scales. They don't have an outer covering of overlapping scales. They actually have this suit of armour almost. It's like a bony set of suit of armor with plates that overlap and interlock. And that makes them look a bit like an exoskeleton of an insect or a crustacean. Sometimes some scientists thought they were maybe shrimp with no legs. But they are fish. And we know that they do have a backbone. Look underneath that bony skeleton. And there's a little tiny articulated spine made out of bone. They're bony fish. And so that's what they are. But why the debate raged on for so long does seem a bit peculiar. But maybe it's just, again, the kind of magical looks that no one could believe that they were a fish. They did, you know, they look too strange for that.
Now, how many different kinds of seahorses are there?
Well, at the latest count, in fact, just in the last year, 5 new species have been found and named. And that leads us to probably a grand total of 39. I say probably because some scientists and taxonomists, the people who have the job of going out and naming species, argue that there are a lot more. And there's certainly, we can't deny that there are more species out there waiting to be discovered. And DNA techniques, genetic techniques are helping us to kind of unpick that a bit. They're also making it a bit more problematic. It's throwing up more questions of what a species is and so on. But I think 39 is it's a good place for us to start. And we can argue whether there are lots more or not. But I think we can stick with that for now.
Our phone lines are open. Give us a call, 1-800-433-8850. Or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. So still discovering species, and one reason might be because they are so hard to find. Why is it so hard to find a seahorse?
Well, there's a couple of reasons, really. Firstly, they're quite small. I mean, the biggest ones are about 35 centimetres, if you stretch their tails.
35 centimetres, so in American, that would be...
Oh, right. Okay, take it about from your wrist to your elbow, that distance.
So that's huge. That's
pretty
big.
That's
an enormous seahorse.
Yeah. And then, but there's a few that are that big. Mostly, they are smaller, say, sort of 3 inches. And the tiniest ones are about the size of your little fingernail. They are so, so tiny. So they can be small, but... they're really tricky. They're masters of disguise, really. They are a little bit like octopus and squid. They have skin that can change colour. And not only that, but they can change the texture of their skin. They can grow weedy filaments, which look like a bit of seaweed. And they also get covered in bits of kind of grub and bits of muck that also help to camouflage them. So they really are amazingly well camouflaged. And they can just change colour to blend into their surroundings. And they will hide. They don't swim very fast. They'll hide behind branches of coral and seaweed. So to be honest, maybe I was in the vicinity of seahorses a few times in the past and I just didn't see them, because I think that does happen quite a bit.
What are the colours that a seahorse can change itself into?
Well, that's a good question. Generally, obviously, in the wild, they'll stick to whatever their surroundings are, but you can get bright pink ones. There's a particular species that lives on a sea fan in Indonesia called the pygmy seahorse. And, there's a few species of pygmies now, but the original one, Barjabans, pygmy seahorse, has bright pink spots, kind of nodules, really, just to camouflage itself brilliantly to look like a sea fan. So they're bright pink. You get bright orange ones, you know, all sorts of browns and greens. And in fact, I met some researchers in Vietnam when I was over there who are trying to breed seahorses. And what they're doing is trying to breed them to be pretty colours so that people can have them as pets. And they found that if you were actually just put one piece of coloured card on one side of the aquarium on the outside, they'll mimic that colour. And so you can have blue, you can have green, pretty much anything you want.
Do you think seahorses make a good pet?
It's a good question. I can absolutely see the appeal. What more magical pet can you have than a seahorse in your own home? And now you can quite easily get seahorses that were bred in captivity. So we're not taking them from the wild. So that kind of maybe ethical and environmental issue isn't really so much of a problem these days. But they are hard work. That's the one thing that I think is stopping me at the moment from having seahorses is they're a lot of hard work to look after. You have to be there. They're very sensitive.
Why do you have to be there?
They have to be fed, mostly. They are hungry creatures. They don't have a very big stomach. So in the wild, seahorses spend most of their days eating. When they're not mating and having babies, they're most of the time they spend is eating these tiny shrimp. Sea monkeys is one of the things that seahorses eat. Luckily now, if you do buy captive bred seahorses, a lot of them have been bred to, or they've been... they've been allowed to feed on frozen food. So that makes it a bit easier. Because before, you had to keep them live food, which meant you had to keep those shrimp yourself as well at home. But that's getting easier now. You can use frozen shrimp most of the time. So they just you need to feed them. You have to put the food in 3, 4, 5 times a day. Plus, keep an eye on them. They can get diseases. They can have problems with skin diseases. You know, they're very sensitive to the water quality. So, you know, they're not just a cat that will look after themselves. They, you know, they're as much as a dog that needs taking for a walk. You don't need to take it for a walk, but you know... And I get the feeling that people who have seahorses become very devoted. They spend a lot of time gazing and longingly and enjoying their seahorses.
Well, I know some owners of seahorses as pets say that they have their own personalities. Do you think that's true?
Well, I think I've heard a lot of talk about that. I haven't, to be honest, spent enough time myself in the presence, unfortunately, of a seahorse. I wish I had. But they swear that they do have some that are cheeky, some that are shy, some that are very, kind of, they will only eat when they're tank mates are there with them too and so on. So I think they probably do have their own personalities.
Helen Scales has written a new book, Poseidon Steed, The Story of Seahorses from Myth to Reality. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation about the role that seahorses have played in capturing the American the human imagination for centuries. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The book is called Poseidon Steed, The Story of Seahorses from Myth to Reality, and the author, Helen Scales, is with me in the studio. Well, before we go to the phones, we should talk about the strange sex life of the seahorse. I mean, one thing, there's the way they mate, which is quite remarkable. Describe it.
It is. So you have male and female seahorse will meet on a seagrass bed or a coral reef or wherever it is that they live. And they will initiate the most elaborate courtship dance. It's just beautiful. I have not seen it in the wild myself, but I've seen footage of it. They come together, their tails will entwine. They dance around and around each other. And the male will often make little clicking sounds, which he actually generates, we think, at the back of his skull by moving around some bones in there. So he's courting the female. Their bodies change colour. They blush their emotions. And they're basically checking each other out, seeing if this is a good partner or not. And if it's all looking good, they'll rise up into the water column. And then they will hold their bodies close, and sometimes their snouts will touch and it would look like a heart shape. It's really quite beautiful. And then a really extraordinary thing happens. The female, out of the female's body, a tube emerges, and she places that tube into the pouch of the male and hands over a whole clutch full of eggs, which goes into his pouch. And there thus begins an extraordinary journey that happens in no other animal in the animal kingdom.
So the male then gives birth. Is that right?
That is right. So he has the eggs from the female. He then fertilizes those with his sperm. And in fact, as you might imagine, that he might just put the sperm straight into his pouch. But because of the way it's evolved through steps of natural selection, the sperm actually comes outside the pouch into the water column first. He then sucks them back up into his pouch. The eggs are fertilized inside his pouch. He then closes off the pouch, seals off the little hole that's at the top of it, and they will settle down, the eggs settle down and actually embed themselves into the wall of his pouch. So very much like a uterus, if you like, in other animals. And then for a couple of weeks, he will gestate. And they will grow and develop into little tiny baby seahorses inside him. And he carefully controls the environment inside his pouch. It's not just a pouch like a kangaroo in that sense. It's actually sealed off. At first, it's very fresh in there to keep the eggs happy. And as the birth time arrives, it approaches after a couple of weeks, he will make it more salty so that they don't have a big salt shock when the seahorses are born. He will provide them with nutrients. He provides them with oxygen and takes away any waste products in the developing babies. And then after a couple of weeks, labour arrives, and this is extraordinary. If you get a chance to see footage of a male seahorse giving birth, it looks painful. These guys are suffering. They are huffing and puffing. I mean, this can take hours. I gather it can even take days for all these babies to come out. He will often use his tail to hold on to something, give himself some purchase, and then just squeeze and squeeze in contractions. It really does look like a painful labour process. And eventually, tiny, fully formed baby seahorses emerge into the world. They range in size, but they're always pretty, pretty tiny. But they're independent. They will drift off, and they won't have any more help from mum or dad. But mum and dad stay together. They every day during his pregnancy, this dancing I was describing continues. They come together every morning. We think it's because the female is really checking out to see how the male's getting on, because she wants to be able to basically give him some more eggs just as soon as the pouch is empty. And so she has to keep checking. They will dance together every morning, and as soon as she arrives and he seems empty, then the courtship begins in earnest, and sooner or later he'll be pregnant again, and the whole cycle repeats so that they can have as many babies in a year as possible, which is really what it's all about.
Well, we rarely have a sex education component of the Diane Rehm Show, but that is really a remarkable story. Well, let's go to the phones. We'll talk first to Sam. He's calling us from Annapolis, Maryland. Sam, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. My work takes me frequently to China, and I was wondering if Ms. Scales knew that they serve seahorses, baby seahorses, in a consomme live, I would say in a coffee cup size bowl and shape. There may be two or three or four. First time I looked in there and saw them swimming, I was obviously amazed. Second part, is the species endangered in any way?
Well, Sam, let's go back to the consomme first. Now, have you actually tasted this?
Oh, yes. It's the broth, and I think I may have swallowed one before I knew, accidentally, and didn't realize. And I was told that it's a male aphrodisiac, and that's why they serve it.
Is it? How does it taste?
It's more like just a regular broth. I think there may be a fish stock or something that they're using, but it's, you know, not much to it. A clear soup or consomme with some seahorses swimming in it, and actually become a source of sense of humor when they bring it to the table.
Interesting. Helen Scales, have you heard about this?
I have not heard about live seahorses being eaten. That is extraordinary. That really is. I mean, I very well know that the Chinese, they do eat seahorses. They mostly use them actually as a medicine. You touched on the idea of them being an aphrodisiac, and that is one thing they're used for male impotence. But you usually take that as a medicine. But to have them alive in a bowl of soup, I've never heard of that. I've seen them being sort of stir-fried and added to soups that way, or maybe on a barbecue kebab sticks are like stuck next to each other. So people do eat them, but this is unbelievable. I have to see this for myself someday. This is, but I can believe it, actually. I can believe they would do that. I certainly don't think it's a particularly nice idea to have them swimming around in soup. But there's a really long history of the Chinese involvement with seahorses. So, you know, it goes back hundreds of years that they've used them as medicines.
Well, now Sam was also asking, is the seahorse endangered in any way? So this is something that people should avoid doing?
Yeah, I mean, that is something that I talk about in the book, and something that I'm personally very concerned about, that what we know about seahorse species is that they are vulnerable to several different aspects of modern life in the oceans. Not only are they sensitive to the environmental changes, to change, shifting climates, warming seas, maybe the acidification of the ocean because of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the changes to their habitats really is what I'm getting to there, that they really have, they're very sensitive, they need those seagrass meadows, those mangrove forests, coral reefs, those types of habitats that they live in. If those are being damaged, then the seahorses themselves will suffer. So that's one aspect. And the other is that, yes, we are as a globe, as human beings, we are exploiting them deliberately for things like Chinese food, for Chinese medicines, a little bit for souvenirs and curios, you know, having a dried seahorse and a bowl of potpourri or something like that, you know. Internationally, you know, there is a big seahorse trade, and scientists are concerned that this is having an effect on populations. So yes, they are endangered. In fact, most of the species, we just don't know enough about them to know how endangered they are. These are such secret creatures that, you know, they're keeping a lot of their secrets still. But we have a few that are listed as endangered already.
But when seahorses are served in soup, these are seahorses that have not been captured in the wild, are they? They've seahorses that have been farmed, presumably, given how difficult it is to get the find the seahorse.
That's a good question. I mean, seahorse farming is something that's increasing, but it is still quite an expensive and labor-intensive activity, so that mostly the seahorses that are being farmed end up being traded as pets, because you can charge quite a lot for a good pet. People are prepared to pay good money for a good, well-bred seahorse. But to make them into medicines is not cost-effective yet, and presumably for foods too. So I suspect, and I'm sad to say, that probably most of the seahorses that are eaten are taken from the wild. And there are ways of catching them and finding them to provide for those types of markets.
So perhaps do not order the seahorse soup the next
time. I personally think that there's probably an alternative. Even if it came down to using them as a medicine, there are alternatives. And given the problems they face, you know, we should be thinking about the impacts it's having.
Do they, in fact, work as a medicine? Is there empirical evidence that they have the effect they're supposed to have?
Well, that, again, is something that I look at in the book, because I wanted very much to understand, first of all, why they're used. And we look back at the history of traditional medicines and why that is. And then what evidence there is that they work. And unfortunately, seahorses are one ingredient in medicines that don't yet have much evidence. And we can't categorically say they don't work. But in a sort of scientific sense, in the way that Western science goes in to look at whether or not a medicine works, the sort of ways of doing trials and looking for maybe molecules that are very active within a seahorse, something unusual that might be having this effect. And people have looked, there have been studies, but still nothing very convincing. I don't think there's anything really totally convincing to say that there's something different going on in the seahorses that's making them useful.
Let's go to Auburn, New Hampshire, and talk to Glenn. Glenn, hi.
Hello. I have a question about mating in seahorses. I'm a ceramic sculptor, and I just started making seahorses, and my original prototype was at a show recently, and there was a great debate over which one was the male and which one was the female. And you may have answered this earlier, but one of them had an extended stomach, and I'm assuming that was the male.
Yep, I think you're right. That's what I would say. Yeah, especially if it's a young male, then it's hard to tell them apart from females because they will look quite alike. But as soon as he begins to become pregnant, you'll either see he's pregnant with a big swollen pouch, and they are extraordinary. They can get huge. If you see a pregnant seahorse, there's no missing it. They're like a balloon, they're enormous. And also afterwards, they'll still show that they've had that extension to their belly. So yeah, the males are the ones with the bigger bellies.
Now, Glenn, why did you choose to use this in your art?
Well, I originally have been dealing with sea turtles, and they were quite popular, and I wanted to come up with something new. And I came across a photograph that said Hippocampus brevicus mating, and that's why I was wondering which one was which, because as you explained earlier, the male is distended later on. So as you said, they come together later on during the pregnancy to get together every morning. So that must have been what the photograph actually was of, instead of the actual mating process, because he's not distended at that point, right?
Yeah, that sounds about right. And in fact, I mean, I think one of the reasons why for such a long time there was a big debate in the scientific circles about which was the, was it the male or the female that actually carried the eggs, was because it was unclear what was going on, really. They do look very similar early on. And you have to be very close, you know, look very closely to see who's doing what with eggs and where the eggs end up and so on. So yeah, until they're fully pregnant, it can be a bit difficult to tell.
Let's go to Gary. Now, Gary, I'm not entirely sure where you're calling us from. Is it Madagascar?
Yes. Hi, Helen. It's Gary Lemmer calling from Shemagi Morandov.
Gary, hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm very well, thanks. Do you have a question?
I do. Well, first I wanted to say congratulations on your dream of the book. Some years ago when we met here, I was very happy, and I'm just glad to hear you. Your voice, and can't wait to see the book. That's really all I want to say. Also, the question is, do you believe there may be seahorses in Bailey Sumer?
That is on the southwest coast of Madagascar, where I was actually a few years ago, and that's when I met Gary, and we were talking about seahorses way back then. So thank you so much, Gary, for your message. I think they could be there. We didn't find any, but I think if we keep looking, they might turn up. There's a lot of seagrass there, so why not?
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Now, we've got an emailer from Dallas named Ed, who says, if the male gives birth, what is the definition of male and female as it applies to the seahorse? What makes him male if he's the one who gives birth?
I love that question. I always get that. And I love the fact that people think, okay, all right, what's going on? How does it make it male and female? And the answer is really very simple. And I'm afraid it's going to take us back to our sex ed classes. It's all about sperm and eggs. And it's all about how an individual hands on their genetic material to the next generation. Their genes are packaged up either in a big egg, which is generally quite large and doesn't move, and then the females who produce eggs. And then the males produce smaller sperm, which are they can move around. And they're cheaper to make because they're smaller, they don't have so much nutrition in them. And that's generally the difference between any animal in the world, whether it's humans, horses, seahorses, frogs, whatever they are. It's sperm and eggs. And it's the male seahorses that still produce the sperm. They may take the eggs on and look after them, but they produce the sperm themselves, and that's why they're male.
Now, we've had seahorses be interesting to humans going back a long way. What's the first evidence of humans paying attention to seahorses?
Well, I think we're certainly looking back thousands of years, and just how many thousands is, you know, a bit of a question mark, but possibly the earliest evidence that people were seeing seahorses and perhaps figuring out what they were was about maybe 6,000 years ago in Australia. In cave paintings in the north of Australia, we find today pictures of something called the rainbow serpent. And in fact, archaeologists have been around the area looking at how this particular this creature, which is very important in the Aboriginal dream time, is spirituality. It's in fact a creator ancestor. It's a creator spirit, a great spirit ancestor that created the land in their mythology. And it can still be seen with painting rainbows across the sky. And if you look in a pond with a water lily in it, you might see this rainbow serpent. But pictures of it drawn on the sides of caves and on rocks. Some of them have this sort of possibly a bit of a resemblance to seahorses. And some archaeologists have looked at whether or not this could be the case. And the pictures do seem to be a mixture of different species. They have kind of features of crocodiles and various different things, and snakes, obviously. But some of them look a lot like a relative of the seahorse called the ribbon pipefish. And they look like a pipefish, which are the long, thin relatives of seahorses, but with more elaborate decoration on them.
And in fact, you write in your book that when you were on your quest to see a seahorse in the wild, You almost saw one, but it turned out to be this ribbon pipefish.
Oh, that was the bootlace pipefish.
Oh,
I think.
Bootlace,
no, but that is a very
yes.
similar one as well. And that was in, if that's the one you mean, that's in Mauritius. And yeah, I was many different adventures I had trying to find seahorses, asking people where to find them. You know, Madagascar was one place, and Mauritius I was there, and they said, yeah, we have seahorses. We definitely have seahorses in the lagoon. We'll take you to see them. We'll be fine. We'll go there. We went and we did this dive. And before I could even do anything, before I could say anything, well, or make a noise, the dive guide thrust this thing into my hand. And it was this bend stick pipefish, I think is what it was called. And it's long and thin, but a little bit like a seahorse. It has a pregnant belly, well, no, semi-pregnant belly. It's not actually truly pregnant, but it has a swelling. And it was very lovely, but it wasn't quite a seahorse. So they were a little bit muddled up there. But yeah, it was almost a seahorse.
Now, but we know from fossil remains that seahorses have actually been around longer before humans started to notice them.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We've, in fact, just recently some fossils have been found in Slovenia in rocks there, and they're 13 million years old, which is the oldest seahorse fossils we've found, because strangely, there aren't many fossil seahorses. You'd think, because they have this hard outer body, that would be make them quite prone to being fossilized, but for some reason there aren't many. These guys turn up, and so that's really put the date really firmly at least 13 million years, if not, we think probably more from genetic evidence. And they haven't changed much since then. They look very much like modern seahorses.
We're talking with Helen Scales about her new book, Poseidon's Steed. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll come back. We'll talk about what seahorses meant to the ancient Greeks, and we'll go back to the phones and take some of your calls and questions, your comments, your own experiences with seahorses. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our Animal Week series continues with a pioneer in veterinary forensics who investigates cases of animal cruelty, a volunteer who helped rescue cats and dogs during Katrina, and three people with Puppies Behind Bars, a program in which inmates train dogs to help disabled veterans. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
We have an email from Keith in Silver Spring, Maryland, who says, I've dived all over the world, but the only place I ever saw a seahorse was, of all places, in the Chesapeake Bay. It was great. And then we have another emailer who says, we were on vacation in Belize, and as a special add-on to a sailing trip, the guides took us to the breeding grounds of the seahorses. There were hundreds of them, all sizes. It was a magical end to a wonderful day on the sailboat. The guide said they are only there a few days a year. And one more emailer who writes, when I was a kid 30 years ago, I saw seahorses fairly often near a jetty in Oak Bluffs on Martha's Vineyard. Many warm water species would ride the Gulf Stream up along the same route hurricanes take along the East Coast to the Cape, the Vineyard, and Nantucket. Since the island's explosion in popularity, the waters around it have become less pristine, and I have not seen a seahorse in many years, so that's too bad. That's a loss. Let's go to Liz, who's calling us from Connecticut. Liz, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, of course.
I just wanted to tell you that we live on the Nyanic River, and my husband, son, and I were out on our boat this summer when my little six-year-old said, "Mom, I found a seahorse," and in Long Island Sound. Actually, Nyanic River goes into the Sound. And I said, "You're kidding." And he said, "No, it wrapped its little tail around my finger," and that's actually what it had done. So it was just the thrill of a lifetime for him. He couldn't show it to enough people. He put it in a little cooler and took it to our neighborhood picnic about an hour later and had a lot to talk about. And it was also pregnant. So it was it made for a lot of good conversation.
Wow, interesting.
Did you put it back at the end?
He just carried it. Yep. I had
Great.
It in the cooler for about an hour.
Fantastic.
And then, everybody thought we were bringing a nice entree or dessert, when in fact we were bringing the seahorse. And then we just walked it over to the river and launched him.
Fantastic. Well, hopefully you've got a lot of seahorse converts now from that. Great work.
Yes, it was great. So I just wanted to comment on that.
All right, Liz, thanks very much for your call. Let's talk to Aaron. He's calling us from Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, Susan. This is a great show, and I hope my mom in Springfield is listening because she helped me raise dwarf seahorses when I was a young kid. I'm going back to 1973 and 74. I believe the species name was Hippocampus zostrae. Fascinating, fascinating creatures. We raised them from the time they were delivered to our house in McLean, Virginia, and developed everything from a large saltwater aquarium, which I'm sure your guests will agree is not the easiest to keep. Had to make sure that the pH was proper. We had to make sure that the tank was seasoned properly. It was quite an involved process. We even raised the little tiny brine shrimp, and I would feed them several times a day when I was at home. And, of course, Mom would take over because she was a stay-at-home mom. She would take over feeding the little darlings when we were at school. Fascinating, fascinating creatures. Unfortunately, they did succumb to the fungus that grows on their skin. And I'll tell you something, as each one died off, I was quite devastated. But I have to tell you something, it made a terrific impact upon my life, and I love these tiny creatures, and I so value that this book is out, and there's more and more interest in seahorses, and hopefully we can keep the species going because they are amazing. We even raised pipefish, and the seahorses would wrap their tails around the pipefish, and they would go racing around the aquarium. And they do have little personalities. One always used to anchor himself towards the bubbler, and he used to like to put his gills up and get a fresh gulp of air or oxygen. And we even had a few pregnant males that did give birth, and that was amazing.
Absolutely. And Aaron, did you name them?
Oh, God, yes. There was Pinky, and there was Greeny, and Bluey, and, you know, as each one passed away and went to that great little seahorse rainbow bridge in the sky, I would fish one out, and I know Mom is probably nodding to this, put them in a little tiny jar and put them in the freezer where they probably stayed until we moved out of that house in 1983.
All right.
but they are just so amazing, absolutely amazing, and I was so excited when I heard that you were going to have this show on.
Oh, well,
and I hope my mom's listening. Thanks, Mom.
All right, Aaron, thanks so much for your call. You know, what is it about the seahorse? Do you think that all these years later can be so exciting to someone who remembers raising them?
It's the way they look. I think it's the way they behave. They are just, they're such special little creatures, and to share their lives with you, I guess, their personalities come out, and you can't stop but just gaze at them and watch them do their thing. They're just like fairy tales come true. They don't seem real, but there they are in front of you. So yeah.
Kelly is calling us from Bethesda, Maryland. I think she saw some seahorses at an aquarium. Kelly, what did they do?
Well, I thought I was imagining it, but I watched for a really long time. It looked like, okay, there was one seahorse who had been captured by a crab, and was being held, and another seahorse had his tail wrapped around that seahorse and was trying to pull it out. And it went on and on and on. I don't know if it's conceivable that fish would behave this way, but it looked like the seahorse was trying to rescue the other one.
Wow. The fact that there was a crab in with the seahorse is a surprise. I would have thought that you keep those guys apart when you have them in aquariums. But seahorses do hang out. They do hold on to each other a lot. They almost have this need, I think, to hold on to something. I think that's one of the things that makes us love them so much. They seem so they're so cute the way they hold on, and they need to, and whatever they find, they'll hold on to it. So if it's another seahorse, then they'll do that too. And I've seen clumps of seahorses, just like dozens almost, kind of holding on to each other. Whether or not this one was deliberately trying to get his friend out of the jaws of the crab, I don't know. I'd like to think so, but I don't know. He could just have been saying, "Hey, my perch is moving. What's going on here?"
Hey, Kelly, did the seahorse manage to save the other seahorse from the crab?
No. And I also wondered why they had a crab in there.
Yeah,
it didn't seem like a good idea. But...
not a good idea, I don't think.
Yeah. Right.
Well, a dramatic moment. We're sorry it ended in tragedy.
Thank you.
All right, Kelly. Thank you for your call. Let's talk about the ancient Greeks. They were quite interested in seahorses.
Yeah, I mean, that is, again, one of the oldest, most ancient sort of records, that we were seeing seahorses and wondering what they are and what they might be and, you know, what they might mean. And it was in the Greek myths we had Poseidon, the Greek god of the sea, who galloped around on his golden chariot in the Greek myths, pulled by four huge hippocampus, which is the Latin name, the scientific name for seahorses, hippocampus. It comes from Greek words, I think, meaning horse and monster, or possibly caterpillar, which would maybe be something to do with their tail. Looks a bit like a caterpillar. Anyway, the hippocampus were a big character in the Greek myths, and they pulled Poseidon around on his many adventures. You can read about that in all sorts of the Greek myths and stories that were written. And in fact, the stories that Greek fishermen believed that the real seahorses they found in their nets occasionally, because you get seahorses in the Mediterranean, they still live there today, that they were the offspring of these giant hippocampus, that these giant half-horse, half-fish creatures that we see in artwork. We've seen, you know, there's mosaics, there's silverware, there's all sorts of representations of hippocampus and Poseidon from those times, from Roman times. Neptune, the god of the Roman god, inherited the hippocampus as well. So that's a great character that was there. And there were all sorts of other creatures that had fish tails stuck onto them, but the horses were one of the main ones.
But a hippocampus, of course, also refers now to a part of the brain. Which came first, hippocampus? The hippocampus in your brain, the hippocampus in the sea?
Well, that's a good question. It was, I think it was the kind of classical hippocampus that came first. Those ancient Greeks had this word for a seahorse. And in fact, Pliny the Elder, I think, came up with stories about seahorses. So we knew well about them back then. And then when that part of the brain was discovered by anatomists, I believe, was it in the 17th century? I'm sorry, I might get that wrong, but it's around then. One of the stories is that the physiologist who found that part of the brain looked like a seahorse. Some people don't think it looks anything like a seahorse at all. In fact, you know, I'm fairly hazy about that, but it is one interpretation of why that's the name is given to that part of our brains. And it's a part of our brain that does all sorts of things, but I think one of the really interesting things is that it helps us to navigate. In fact, there was a study of London cab drivers, and they have to take this test before they can become a London cab driver so that they know the roads of London so they can take their customers anywhere. And London cab drivers have bigger hippocampus than other people. And in fact, the longer they have been a cab driver, the bigger their hippocampus is. So that your internal seahorse can be trained to help you find your way around.
We have a question from Neil, who writes this from Norman, Oklahoma. He says, in more ancient times, in more isolated island cultures, did seahorses have a different name if that culture had yet to see a real horse?
That's a really good question. And I have to say, I don't really know. I don't actually know of other, off the top of my head, no, I don't know other words that other cultures have given to seahorse. It really is that's quite invasive. The hippocampus word is one that's really come to stick. But I would have thought most cultures had some idea of what a horse is by that stage. I mean, that's the most obvious thing to compare them to. The cheval de mer is the French word for it, the horse of the sea.
Ben has a sort of related question. He emails us. He says, are seahorses named in the same way in other languages? Are they generally known as seahorses.
Yeah, they are. There are different, as I say, the French, it's cheval de mer. I'm going to be completely stumped for any other words for seahorse. But generally, that is the interpretation of the word seahorse. Often it's hippocamp. In French as well, you call it hippocampe, which is the Latin name. That's the genus name. So all seahorses begin with hippocampus and then have another name of their species. So this generally an interpretation on sea and horse.
Let's go to Aurora, Illinois, and talk to Mark. Mark, hi. Thanks for holding on.
Good morning. I'd like to comment on Helen's verve. I don't know if you've had thoughts of being a public speaker or a teacher, but you should be. I had nary a thought about seahorses before the program, and in the last 45 minutes, there's nothing in the world but seahorses. I would like to ask about some comparisons with dolphins and whales as far as the intelligence of the animal. I think you've been implicitly answering that, but also, do they make sounds and do they receive sounds as a way of navigating in the world and communicating?
All right, Mark, what good questions. Thank you.
That's fantastic. Well, dolphins and whales are mammals, very, very different creatures to fish, which are the seahorses. So we're starting from a very different basis there. And I don't think we've really found any fish that are anywhere near as intelligent as those marine mammals are, in terms of their ability to communicate, their social structure, and so on. But you're quite right that to some extent, seahorses, they live these social lives with their partners. So there is some degree of understanding and knowing what's going on in the world around them. They do make some noises, not like dolphins. They don't emit sounds to see, because that's what dolphins do often. They emit these pulses of sound to look at the environment around them. Seahorses don't have that kind of sonar. But they do make little clicking sounds. In fact, and there's a nice story from when that was first described by scientists in Victorian times. And in fact, one scientist was drawing a couple of seahorses in a glass jar on the top of his desk. And one was in one jar and one was in the other jar. And suddenly he noticed that there was a sound coming from one, a little clicking sound, kind of a buzzing almost. And then the other seahorse across the desk would respond. And these two seahorses seem to be talking to each other across the desk. And that's just wonderful. I mean, I haven't heard a seahorse make that noise, but apparently they do. And for a long time, people didn't know where that was coming from. And you could feel it. I don't encourage you to touch a seahorse, but if you were to touch the back of the head of a seahorse, you can feel a kind of buzzing vibration. And apparently that is the kind of source of this noise. And in fact, studies have shown that it is this movement at the back of the skull that makes this clicking. So they can communicate. I don't suppose it's as complex a communication as dolphins, but then we don't know. So, you know, we should find out.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Winston-Salem, North Carolina. William's been holding on. William, you're on the air.
Yes. I've heard that some species are venomous, poisonous, or whatever. Could you talk a little bit about those?
Interesting.
Poisonous seahorses. Wow. I don't think so. Well, it's interesting that you say that because back in Roman times, one of these early depictions and writings about seahorses talked about them being used as a medicine and also as a poison. And that if you burnt a seahorse and crumbled it up and sprinkled it into someone's wine, that would be a good way of bumping them off. But the reality of whether that's true or not, I really don't think there is. We haven't found any chemicals that are in seahorses. There are some fish that can get toxins in them from the food that they eat. Ciguatera toxin is something that kind of accumulates from bacteria, cyanobacteria, blue-green algae that live in the sea. But whether seahorses do that, I've never heard of an occurrence of that happening. So I don't think so. But maybe if we can encourage people to think that they are poisonous, then we wouldn't eat so many of them.
All right, William, thanks for your call. Larry is calling us from Detroit. Hi, Larry.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I just wanted to say that back in 1984, my teenage daughter and I got certified as scuba divers, and we traveled with the family to Bonaire to do our open water dives. And while we were in one of those dives, we came across several seahorses, and we actually have a photograph of my 14-year-old daughter holding this seahorse, in effect, in her hand. And, of course, it was fascinating to me, but for a 14-year-old, it was absolutely magical. And we appreciate that you put this program on today and gave us all some insight into seahorses.
All right, Larry, thanks so much for that remembrance.
Bonaire is a great place to see seahorses, in fact. There are at least 20 sites where seahorses are found in Bonaire, because one thing about seahorses is they don't move very fast. They don't have their big tail fin. They just hold on to it with their sort of their trunk-like tail, and they actually they don't like to move from home. They stick to the same spot, so you can keep going back to that same spot and find them. So now, in fact, visitors, divers to Bonaire can ask local dive guides, and they can be taken to see the resident seahorse populations, which is really great because it's proving to be a really important way of creating incentives to look after the marine environment, because you have your seahorses that divers will come see and you, like you say, come away with a really magical experience that's going to stay with them, and they're going to really look out for these guys and think about them in the world today.
I'm afraid, out of time. I think we've probably sparked a lot of interest in seahorses among those who raised them, found them, had read about them. But thank you so much for joining us this hour, Helen Scales, to talk about your new book. It's called Poseidon's Steed, The Story of Seahorses from Myth to Reality. Thanks so much for being with us on The Diane Rehm Show.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.